Souza, John Philip Souza. That's his band. He did a version of his band. Okay, well, and the culture for today. Kristen decided we couldn't be playing marches today because it's voting day. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that everybody has or will vote.
I voted too. Stay in mail. I'm a citizen. I became a citizen when I was.
You shouldn't let little things like citizenship bother.
What?
You shouldn't let little things like citizenship.
Where did you go? How did you get?
My dad got citizenship, and therefore, no, I think my dad and my mom got citizenship, and therefore, my brother and I automatically became citizens.
Dr. Modell?
Yes. We were young enough.
This is totally, like, spur of the moment.
This is spur of the moment. Okay.
But just coming off of midterms, can we kind of take a minute to say what we're thankful for?
Sure.
Okay.
You sure want to do that before you get the...
I don't have histo, but I just want to say.
No,
is over there.
No, I just.
She's thankful she doesn't have histo.
No, I just want to say thank you to anyone and everyone that was supportive over the last week and who put up with a bitchiness attitude on my part, if it was directed or unintentionally directed in your direction. Due to the high stress volume, I just, you know, want to say it was a very stressful 10 days we're coming off of, and I just really appreciate and am thankful to this group that I'm in. So, thank you. And good luck to everyone who does have histo. You guys will do awesome on it. It was one of my favorite exams so far, outside of physiology, which I got to drink wine while I was doing my test.
It was the line wine you liked.
It was the one.
Yeah. You're drunk.
We're assuming that Rich will actually get it printed off. That's okay. He has enough of them.
I was making up our own.
I just want to second that. It's
can I have
really
that
study groups have been really awesome and occurring sporadically. And they have the fear that the finals or midterms are way better than any other.
And I was really thankful walking into that anatomy exam and having everything decorated, all the upper classes. It just made me feel like I was supported, not just within this group, but within the entire community. And that all these people were rooting for me. It was really, really amazing, because I've never had even small group support before. So, really amazing.
I'm really thankful for the courses now makes previewing seem really easy and doable. Whereas before it seemed like a lot of work and I'm like, that's nothing.
So true.
Any other comments about midterms? So I have some questions. How was it? Was it worth all the stress of making that or considering those midterms high-stake events?
I can't tell you it's not.
Until you have to until you have the other midterm.
Yeah.
Let me suggest to you that we've talked about this a little bit. We've talked about it a lot. And Frank kind of alluded to it yesterday. First-year students have so much of their lives wrapped up in numbers, into scores. And oftentimes, what happens is they see a score that they decide is not good, regardless of whether or not it's good. And what happens is they decide that they're not worthy of some reason or another, and they're not good enough. What happens if? What happens if? So let me tell you the story of Sarah Zeese. Sarah Zeese was a friend of mine, and I worked with her sister in a lab at the University of Minnesota. That's how I got to Minnesota. She and I took organic chemistry together. Sarah grew up in Iowa, went to a Catholic high school, and I don't think Sarah in her whole life, her whole high school life, got under 98, maybe, by exam. And then she came to Minnesota and she went to St. Catherine's College, a small college, and she never got below 95. And then she came to the University of Minnesota. And how many of you had organic chemistry? And I don't know if they still do that segment. Organic chemistry? Yes, no. And for exams, did you have blue books? And did you have to learn syntheses and write down all kinds of syntheses and stuff like that?
Yeah.
That was the first organic test. And we took the test and then got it back. And Sarah came down from the lab here. Because it was the worst score that she ever got. It didn't make any difference that it was the top score in the class. It wasn't a 95. And if it wasn't a 95, then it meant that she wasn't any good. And there's so much of that kind of stuff wrapped up in those numbers. And what you have to do is realize that now your life is not about the numbers. Your life is about what you learn and what you can do. And so if, in fact, you don't do well on that test, whatever that test is, you don't look at that test and say, oh, what a horrible thing, I'm no good. You look at that test and say, here's an opportunity. And what's an opportunity for? It's an opportunity to learn something. Because what happens, you know, a lot of people say, well, what are the right answers? Okay, next time I see that, I'll know that. And they don't think about, why did I answer what I answered the way I answered it? And we're going to talk a lot about that when we get to diagnostic wisdom. In one way, you'll find out that most of the time, your answers had nothing to do with what you knew or didn't know about physiology. And all the studying that you did for physiology has good information in your head. Think about it in various ways. But when it comes time to put that down on a test, or on a quiz, or an exam, you don't do it. Why don't you do it? Oh, because, and we've talked about this before, you don't read the question. And, or you say, okay, what does he want me to put down here? Because if I just answer the question, that's too easy. What is he really looking for? The answer is he's looking for the answer to the question. So a lot of people say, no, it can't be that easy. Love is always. Or they don't read the question. They see these little words that they skip over. You know, words like not. Words like only. Things like that. And so you take your time and realize that this is an opportunity to find out what you don't know as well as you did and what you can learn from it. And it's always going to be a positive experience if, in fact, that's the case. You look at an exam and you say, what is it asking? What do I know about this? And if I don't know anything about this, what makes sense to me? Because what a lot of folks do is they say, okay, what do I remember about this? And they go back, what did he say? What did she say? What did I read? Well, I read page 65. I remember everything on page 65. But maybe this was on page 67. I don't remember. So on. And then that starts to influence the next thing, the next question, which influences the next question. Pretty soon you look at the clock and say, God, I'm only a number 3. And I only have 45 minutes left. How am I going to get through the other 20, 30, 40 questions? You take your time, you take one at a time, and later on we can talk about how to take test. For Rich's test, I will tell you one thing. I will give you a tip about maybe that I was just thinking about the other day as we were looking at a student on the HAP test. Rich has a habit of writing, lots of times, writing 2 or 3 lines of information and he asks the question. Now, the reason he does that is because reason he does that is because he might talk about some of that in a week or two, and he wants to give you a preview. That's part of the reason. Sometimes it has something to do with it, but what happens is you start reading that question. And as soon as you read the first page, the first line, you say, what do I know about this? And you start trying to remember everything you know about this. And then you go to the second line. It says something similar or something different. What do I know about this? So by the time you get to the question, that is the line that has a question mark on it. Okay? You're so finished with all kinds of information, with all these other things, and then you don't read the question anyway, that you don't choose the right question. So the first thing to recognize is in richest questions, richest problems, usually the question is the thing with the question mark after it. So the thing I thought about the other day is, if I read the question first, before I read the two or three introductory sentences, if I read the question first, I'm going to know what it is that I'm looking for in that description. And all the extraneous stuff that I would think of afterwards, I wouldn't think of. It's like reading a passage and saying, okay, I got to remember everything in the passage. And then I'll get a question about it. As opposed to reading the question and then looking to the passage to find something about the answer. If you have that big, long description thing, two, three lines, instead of reading that first, find out what the question is. Say, what am I thinking about? What is this about? And now, what is it in that little description that's relevant to my answer? And the other thing I tell people to do is read the question and look at the first answer. Decide whether it's right or wrong, or whether it could be right, could be wrong. Then read the question again and look at the second answer. Then read the question again, look at the third answer. Read the question again, look at the fourth answer. The reason to do that is because people who read the question and then read the answers, 1, 2, 3, 4, by the time they get to the second or third answer, they forgot what the question is. And then students want to know, they're looking for the answer that says the truth. Doesn't make any difference if it answers a question or not. Is this true? Well, it's true, but it's not relevant. It's called a detractor. That's why multiple choice tests have these detractors. And so if you read the question, then you cover up the answers. Read the question, cover up the answer, look at the first answer. Read the question, look at the second answer. Read the question, look at the third answer. And then if you have more than one that looks like it's right, you say, what makes sense to me? Not what do I remember, what do I know, what makes sense? Okay? Questions, comments? And you will get through these 2 weeks. And you're not going to have another 2 weeks like this. Next year it's all different. You know why it's different?
One week.
You know why it's different?
It's not the first time.
Because what?
It's not the first time.
It's not the first time you've done it. Your whole attitude is going to be different next year because you're not going to be worried about failing. You shouldn't be worried about failing now. All right. Any other comments, questions, words of advice for everybody, anybody?
This Saturday, I'll be running another review, and it's in 184, and the time is 1 to 3. So, anybody who's got questions or confusion over things we've covered, bring that in to you and talk about it.
Was Frank helpful yesterday?
It was fun.
Good?
The singing was great.
Yeah. Think you want to sing again someday?
Yeah.
Okay. So, somebody wrote me a note that said, I'd like to gain more confidence in my singing, so I would sing. And my answer to that was, generally you sing for yourself. And so you don't worry about the people around you. They don't care what you sound like. You have fun.
Like
what? Like yeah.
Someday maybe I'll Frank play the accordion. He's talked about for years and years and years. He uses all the rules. Dr. Modell, I have this fellow's rash. Do you have anything for fellow's rash? And since I came to Bastyr, is there any naturopathic thing you can give me to put on my bellows rash? Bellows rash?
Bellows.
Bellows
in the chest.
Bellows in the chest, yeah. Bellows from the accordion. It's very pro-accordion. He was director of the music department in Edmonds School District for a long time. A school levy finally got passed. Finally got passed after years and years of trying. So they had this big pot of money. He called up and said, okay, we got this money. So we should get an accordion for every elementary school kid so they can learn to play accordion. Okay, we're talking about cardiac muscle, right?
Yes.
Questions about cardiac muscle we're talking about. Got it all. That's great. That's really wonderful. Okay. Inside the sarcoplasmic reticulum was higher than the concentration of the cytosol. And so when calcium moved in there, we also said that the concentration of the cytosol calcium increased, and as a result of that, we saw some movement within the cytosol toward troponin. And calcium bound troponin caused troponin to move, which then revealed the binding site for myosin heads on the actin, and the myosin head bound to the actin. There was a power stroke to push the actin over. ATP came along and took off, caused the release of that binding, and recocking of the head. We ended up with a whole bunch of myosin head cycles, which caused movement of the actin inward and caused either shortening or development of force. Okay? And at the same time that was going on, there was an active calcium pump pumping calcium back into the cytosol. And when enough got pumped in so that the concentration of the back into from the cytosol into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and as that pool or that reservoir of calcium fell, there was less and less binding to troponin, and then the binding sites then were covered again. There was no place for the heads to bind. The elastic elements pulled back on the myosin and the muscle relaxed. Okay, so we up to speed there. Remember all that? That was the last problem on the diagnostic quiz. The muscle problem. So then, as far as this conversation was concerned, we said we look at a ventricular muscle cell and we look at the relative permeabilities to three ions, the sodium, the potassium, and the calcium, and added a new ion. Different than the nerve or the skeletal muscle membrane. And on the basis of the relative permeabilities, we predicted something that had a shape that looked something like this, where an action potential. We didn't talk about how this got depolarized. We'll talk about that later today. So we talked about that this membrane got depolarized and opened sodium voltage-gated sodium channels with time and activation gates, the very same kind of gates that we talked about in the skeletal muscle and the axon. And as a result of that, depolarization took place in the same way that we saw in an axon and a skeletal muscle. But we found then that there were some voltage-gated calcium channels and voltage-gated potassium channels, and as a result, of the change in relative permeability, we found that some potassium moved out, causing a repolarization, and some calcium moved in, and as a result of the balance between those two, we saw this plateau. And at this point, we saw that the calcium permeability decreased and the potassium permeability increased, and we saw repolarization. And we said, well, that's interesting. What did we notice about it? We noticed that this was 250 times longer than the action potential of skeletal muscle. And a number of people said, how come I don't see these changes? And how come this is going straight up and it didn't look that way when we looked at the axon and the skeletal muscle? We said the reason was because that whole 1 millisecond was buried in the thickness of this line. So because the scale is so much bigger, you don't see that over here. Then we asked another question. The question we asked was, if we assume that cardiac muscle is striated muscle, and if we assume that the contraction mechanism is similar to contraction mechanism in other striated muscle we talked about, that is skeletal muscle, what would we expect to see in terms of contraction in this muscle? And we concluded that if the two contraction mechanisms were the same, when the cytosolic calcium concentration increased, I would start to see contraction. And where do I see cytosolic calcium increase? Right here. Because calcium is coming into the cell. And so we said, oh, this is different. We said that in the skeletal muscle, the action potential must be completed before contraction begins, because it's the action potential in the skeletal muscle that causes or enables the release of calcium into the cytosol. And here, calcium is coming in from the outside. So we would expect the contraction to start somewhere in here. Okay, are we up to speed there?
I was just wondering, because
Other questions?
So at what point does the contraction end?
Oh, when would the contraction end? Well, not all the calcium. Enough would be gone in my sense. That's going to happen out here somewhere. Okay? We'll look at that a little more closely later, but you're right. So I don't know for sure where, but I know that it's not. Main thing is it starts here, and it's going to go as long as the calcium is, as long as the calcium is high enough in the cytosol. And then we ask the question, so are we up to date here? Does all this make sense?
Sure. Yeah, kind of. I just have some questions about this right here. I'm trying to figure
out. Frank DeMiro. No, that's.
I just love it.
Okay.
Thanks for answering my question.
Yeah.
So this is permeability of sodium into the cell increases, and then once it hits point permeability of sodium into the cell decreases, and permeability of calcium into the cell increases. Is that what each arrow?
No.
I'm having a hard time understanding what each.
So here's what he asked. He said, does this mean the permeability into the cell increases? And does this mean the permeability into the cell increases? So tell me what permeability means. Translate that into what's going on in the membrane.
I would greater flow because there's less resistance.
Okay, so permeability means less resistance.
An increased permeability.
Means less resistance, okay? Or more open channels.
Yes.
So the permeability doesn't say anything about the direction of movement. What tells you about the direction of movement?
Gradient.
So this says that the permeability of the membrane, the sodium, increases. This says that sodium channels of some sort open. The way that I know that sodium comes into the cell is because I know that the concentration on the outside of the cell is greater than the concentration inside the cell. So this says the permeability of the membrane to sodium decreases. So voltage-gated sodium channels are opening here, and the inactivation gates are starting to close here. And so here the permeability is decreasing because the gates are closing.
Okay.
The movement is in the same direction because the gradient hasn't changed. Okay, now I come to this arrow. This says there's an increase in permeability to calcium. It means the calcium channels have opened. So now I have to say, which way is calcium going to move through that membrane? And it's going to move along the gradient. So is the calcium concentration in the extracellular fluid greater or less than the calcium concentration in the intracellular fluid?
Greater.
It's greater. How do I know that?
Because if there is enough calcium inside the cell, then it would be contracting already.
Well, how do I know that from my past experience?
The calcium binds to the troponin.
But that's happening inside the cell. How do I know from my past experience? Life is cumulative. How do I know from my past experience that the calcium concentration is higher in the extracellular fluid than it is in the intracellular fluid?
Because we saw
the
skeletal muscle.
Because you saw it where? You saw it in the skeletal muscle? No, you didn't see it in the skeletal muscle. Where did you see it?
Circle.
No, that's inside the cell. You saw it where?
Oh, in the nerve.
In the terminal bouton. The action potential propagated down the axon and got to the terminal bouton. It caused voltage-gated calcium channels to open, and calcium moved into the cell. So from that past experience, I know that extracellular calcium concentration is higher in the outside of cells than the inside of cells. And should the extracellular fluid in the heart be any different than the extracellular fluid anywhere else? The answer is no, because it's all extracellular fluid. So I know that from past experience, so I don't have to remember that. It's something I know already from a long time ago.
So the calcium that comes in from the action potential that's coming from it into the cell through the voltage-gated calcium channels, that's transmitting the action potential, and it's unrelated to the calcium that's coming out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum and attaching on the tryptomycin in different places.
So let's talk about what you really meant. That's not what you said. Okay? What you really meant was that the action potential came down the axon, caused opening of voltage-gated calcium channels. Calcium came into the terminal bouton and ended up causing release of neurotransmitter, in that case acetylcholine, which then moved across the synaptic cleft, opened ligand-gated channels, which caused depolarization of the sarcolemma and initiation of an action potential in sarcoplasmic. So what I've said is something that you implied was that the action potential somehow jumps from the axon to the sarcoplasmic. What I said is no. There are a couple steps there. And the action potential is all done in the axon and gone. And the new action potential starts in the sarcoplasmic. Then your real question was, is that calcium in the bouton different than the calcium that comes in the sarcoplasmic reticulum? That's absolutely true. Calcium in the sarcoplasmic reticulum is in the sarcoplasmic reticulum inside the muscle cell. And the calcium that goes into the terminal bouton is extracellular. Anything else?
But in the cardiac muscle, it's not. It's different.
Oh, but in a cardiac muscle, it's different. What is that?
Well, I guess I can't actually remember what exactly your question was, but I was hearing it as a question about cardiac muscle. Were you asking about...
No, I was asking about the previous one.
So in a cardiac muscle, it's different. What's different? In a cardiac muscle, there's no nerve, one. Two, the calcium that's entering the cell from the extracellular fluid is involved to some extent with contraction, and it also does something else.
It triggers the release of more calcium
from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So that's what in the cell. So now we came to this picture. And we said in this picture, we didn't say that. We just said that now, didn't we? So now we said, here's the action potential we've been talking about. Calcium enters this cell, and some of that calcium starts the actin and myosin interacting, but the main thing that this does is it triggers opening of calcium channels. Calcium triggers opening of calcium channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which allows that calcium to exit the sarcoplasmic reticulum, come into the cytosol, and initiate this contraction. So that was the difference that we saw. And so the T-tubules in this arrangement doesn't have a whole lot to do or anything to do with propagation of action potentials, changing the voltage on the inside. It's mostly then there because it has calcium channels in it.
Is that the action potential that's opening the calcium channel?
depends on how you define your terms.
Well, if you're, are, okay, so first question I guess would be, are the calcium channels on the sarcolemma voltage gated?
Yes.
So then, if...
And I wouldn't call it, well, I would hesitate to...
Not
okay,
never mind,
go ahead. Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Along the membrane.
Yeah.
So I guess...
cardiac sarcolemma. Yeah, okay, go ahead.
In order to open those voltage-gated channels, you need to have an active potential being propagated along the membrane, right?
No.
Okay.
So here's the difference. Here's the difference. Okay. In the axon, we had to have a action potential propagated along the axon to open voltage-gated calcium channels. So they were, you could consider them two different events. In this case, we have to have a depolarization of the membrane, which is the action potential. And this calcium channel being open becomes part of the action potential.
I understand that. I guess okay. I was thinking, okay, so every time the calcium comes in, it carries a charge and it helps the action potential. But the initial excitation is started from the sodium rushing in. So I guess I was viewing that as being the main event for the propagation of the action potential. And then the calcium kind of helped. But the calcium's main function was to come into the cell and trigger the release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Or you wouldn't view one as being more important than the other. Because from this graph, you have the... ton of sodium in, and then the calcium.
A little bit of sodium comes in.
Oh, okay.
I know, but
so
they lie. Yeah. Sodium comes in fast, right?
Okay.
that's the rate as opposed to the amount.
Okay.
But go ahead.
And then the calcium comes in slow because, I guess I view that as you've already started to build up positive charge on the inside of the membrane, so the calcium is not going to come in as fast because you're only using the calcium gradient, not the calcium and the voltage gradient. Is that correct or not?
Okay. So let's go back to what Charles asked. Is there some of this wrapped up in there? That diagram and that arrow doesn't say anything about
that's fine.
Alright. The reason that calcium enters more slowly is that the permeability of the membrane to calcium increases more slowly. So what we're seeing in here is that voltage-gated sodium channels open quickly, and the permeability increases very quickly. The voltage-gated calcium channels open more slowly. And so they open over a longer period of time. The gradient is what causes calcium to move in. It moves in more slowly because the number of channels opening is not opening as fast. And here you see that more potassium channels are opening more quickly. And so the permeability is greater and the potassium is greater.
Okay. So, just for my own clarification.
Yes, please.
So the sodium and potassium curves will look the same if it was on a time scale similar to skeletal muscle or just the sodium side? Because if they look the same, then it seems like the calcium just maintains that state of depolarization.
I think I would say just the sodium side.
So what makes the potassium more voltage-gated channels? Is that what's allowing it to leave so quickly instead of being more of a slope?
Well, if you look at this picture.
I think the reason the projector doesn't work is it's not turned on.
this was a change of permeability of potassium, change of permeability. And which is, and this slope is decreasing, while this slope is increasing. So what's happened? I have less, because the permeability is decreasing, I have less calcium coming in, which is now going to decrease the rate of any rate of depolarization.
Right.
And I have an increase in the amount of potassium leaving, which is going to increase rated repolarization. So it's really the combination of these two events that ends up allowing permeability and allowing that repolarization to take place.
I guess it just seems like the potassium and how it drops straight down. It seems like there must be some
increase will increase the permeability. Yes.
Yeah.
So the quantitative difference between the number of potassium channels and the number of calcium channels, there is a quantitative difference, a significant quantitative difference. So I would say that the number of potassium channels that are open, there's a lot more of them.
Thank you.
Do you have an animation of this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I already did that.
Can you demonstrate?
Oh, no, that's not the one you want. No, I don't.
So I guess looking at the figure 7 that you just had up that shows kind of the, you know, as the potassium channels, the permeability is decreasing and then the calcium is increasing. To me, they almost look inversely proportional, but you're saying that there's really a discrepancy in...
Yeah, they do, because these are not the same scales.
Okay.
And so that these scales, you notice, don't have numbers on them. See,
sure.
They're kind of relative scales and not the actual scales. So
okay.
I think there's a big difference in the numbers.
Okay, because if you just look at the shape of a potato,
right.
Well, it kind of implies that, you know, the same numbers of
right.
channels, and that's just not
right. Right.
Okay.
Said that this scale, this looks like an action potential from an axon or a skeletal muscle. And this whole time is about 1 millisecond.
Yeah.
And so that varied in this line.
So our action potential is varied way over there?
No.
What do we call that?
This little thing doesn't exist in this muscle. This exists. Yeah, the question that was asked was, how come this line goes straight up? And this one took some time to get up. And the answer was, because this time is all squished, and this probably does the same thing, but you don't see it because of time scale. No.
I think a while ago you said that the sodium channels weren't on the sarcolemma, but were on the tubule and cardiac muscle cell. Way back.
No, I said.
Where can you show on F9, figure 3-7, where the sodium channels are?
This whole membrane contains those channels that give this characteristic pattern. So if we think about, I don't think about propagation of this action potential along a cardiac muscle cell. Why not? Because that's really, really theory, the way I do about an axon. Growing the action potential from here to here, it's propagated. I could think about propagation in the same way as I think about the propagation on a skeletal muscle. But that propagation is so fast that if I think about this whole action potential taking place along this whole membrane at the same time, that does me just as well.
So when I talk about propagation of the action potential in cardiac muscle, what I'm really talking about is propagation from one cell to the next. We'll come to that.
Along the sarcolemma.
We'll come to that. So the, what we have is, we're going to come to that now. Tell me about, wait a minute, this is a good opportunity. So we have a histology exam this afternoon. You talk about cardiac muscle?
Yeah.
Did you do that? Yeah. Yeah, what? Tell me about it. What do you find in cardiac muscle that you don't find in skeletal muscle?
Come on.
Intercalated disc. And what's an intercalated disc? It's a gap junction. And what's a gap junction?
A hole.
A communication between cardiac cells. Okay. So now, let's well, now, is this really what a cardiac cell looks like? No.
You said
you drew some cardiac cells. And I told Rich you drew this, and he said, no, he wouldn't draw that because he only knows how to draw boxes. Let's say that this cell membrane, cell A, depolarizes. And so sodium comes in, we'll say sodium comes in right there. And calcium comes in there. Potassium leaves around. If sodium and calcium come in there, what happens inside that cell? It contracts, but what else happens inside that cell? A what? A signal is sent through the gap junction. What does that mean?
I think some sodium and calcium are going to...
It means what?
I assume some sodium and calcium are going to go through the gap.
She assumed that some sodium and calcium are going to go through. Why? Because there's a gradient of positive charges. So as soon as you have a positive charge coming here, some positive charges are going to move through there. Why? Because they can. And if that happens, what's going to happen to the cell membrane in this cell? It's going to become depolarized. And if it's depolarized enough, what's going to happen to the sodium, voltage-gated sodium channels, the time and activation gate in that cell? It's going to open. And now I have an action potential in this cell. And so what you see is, what you see is that the action potential gets propagated from this cell to that cell to that cell through those gap junctions, through those intercalated discs. And so one of the things we're going to concern ourselves with is the pattern that that might happen. And what happens if that pattern gets screwed up? Is this making sense?
Then from one cell to the next, the role of potassium, does that stay? I mean, once the... Does the same pattern exist then as far as for the channels for potassium?
Okay. What do we want to do now? Before we
take a break.
I got cheese. that have a religious affiliation are more likely and are staunchly religious, like are more likely to go conservative.
Holy crap, holy.
Holy crap, holy. excited to see it.
Propagation of the action potential along here.
just the increased amount of area, like surface area.
Well, let's go back and let's think about why I might think this way or another way. If I look at a piece of membrane, if I look at this piece of membrane and this piece of membrane, they all have the same kind of channels on them. And if we want to take the argument that we did with the axon, we could say that, okay, this piece, when I'm showing displaying action potential, and then this piece, and that piece, and that piece. And that's fine. Except that in the cardiac muscle, I can't see the relevance of that.
No, I'm not asking about cardiac, I'm asking about skeletal.
So if I look back at a sarcoplasmic reticulum in a skeletal muscle.
Is it just because you're increasing the amount of surface area, which allows more force in that specific area to be open?
It's the same, the propagation the skeletal muscle tissue is conceptually the same as the propagation of the action potential along an axon.
Okay. It's just that here because calcium is what ends up going into channels for more calcium, it doesn't necessarily help the cause.
It doesn't help me to think about it that same way.
Okay.
Because where I think about an axon having a synapse with a skeletal muscle causing contraction. That's causing contraction of one muscle. And in order for that axon, in order for that synapse to be effective, the action potential has to be propagated from the site of its initiation down to the T-tube.
Could you
see
that last line?
Yeah, so if I... Here's the motor end plate. And right here is the initiation. Oh, I can't see that. Okay, right here is the initiation of the action potential. That's where voltage-gated sodium channels time actually start. And so if I want to think about how this action potential gets to over here, I'm thinking of propagation in the same way as we thought about for an axon.
Right, and I understand that. And so, I think I understand. I think I.
And when we get to the cardiac muscle, I think about everything happening in this membrane at pretty much the same time, because I'm not concerned about the action potential getting from one place to another on that cell. I'm more concerned about propagating from this cell to this cell to that cell. That's why I don't think about it the same way.
Okay.
I could, but I don't gain anything.
Okay.
I have a
question.
Yep.
So does in a skeletal muscle cell, you don't have trigger calcium? Is that correct?
That's right, you don't.
Okay.
Skeletal muscle is the action pressure going by that causes the opening of the channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Here it's calcium that comes into the cell.
So,
the skeletal muscle, the action potential is what triggers the opening of gates in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. In the cardiac muscle, it's this calcium that's entering the cell.
I have a question.
Pardon?
Can you say that again, please?
Somebody help me.
Are there any...
What did I say? What's the difference in the sarcoplasmic reticulum between the major difference in release of calcium to the sarcoplasmic reticulum in the cardiac muscle compared to the skeletal muscle?
The cardiac muscle. muscle, the calcium channels are opened by calcium coming into the cell. And in muscle cell, the sodium channels, or the calcium channels are opened by the voltage caused by the sodium channels opening and causing the action potential to go along the membrane. So it's voltage versus light.
Sure. Well, we didn't hear it.
Well, I was wondering with all the calcium that was coming in, the only pump that I thought, I was looking just at that first half, was the pump to push the calcium into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and so that's thinking eventually you get an excess of calcium inside, but then I looked at the rest of the picture and saw the calcium pumps pushing outside.
So let's move to this side. Let's move to this side of the picture. And do I find this ATPase pump here?
Yes.
Why?
Because
it's all sarcoplasmic reticulum in the same cell. Okay? Do I find these carriers over here?
Yes.
Okay. It's all the same cell. So what is the left, what is the right side of this tell us? Thank you. Yep. You decide you need a therapy type.
How the calcium is put away is what the right side is about.
How the calcium is put away. Okay. And so we see something here that's essentially the same as we saw in the skeletal muscle. We saw an ATPase pump moving calcium from the cytosol into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And why is it necessary to have an active pump? Because it's going against the gradient, because the calcium concentration on the inside is higher than the calcium concentration on the outside. So the reason that you have to have a pump is because you're pumping against the gradient. The consequences of that is that you don't have continuous contraction. Okay? So think about it.
So even though you're breathing
Oh, you haven't released all the calcium. You released some calcium. Okay? Just like we release some calcium in the skeletal muscle. You didn't release it all. And then we talk about this mechanism. We talk about that mechanism up here where we have a secondary active transport pump. We've seen that before. And we have another primary active transport pump. There's a significant amount of calcium that gets pumped back out into the extracellular fluid. And it's driven in this secondary active transport by a sodium-potassium pump, the same way we talked about glucose being transported in the proximal tubule. So, gee, that's not a new thing. That's something we've seen before. What do you think will happen to the calcium reservoir inside this cell if I slow that sodium-potassium pump down? What's going to happen?
The calcium
and the cytosol, what's going to happen to it?
It's going to increase.
It's going to increase. And what will that cause to happen in terms of contraction? It's going to stay where?
Sustain,
okay. Now, one of the things that we said about skeletal muscle was that when that calcium was released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, it was enough to bind with all the troponin sites. So that every time we had calcium coming into that cell, there was a maximum response of the actin and myosin for that given amount of calcium. And if we we increase the amount of calcium by having a second stimulus, a second action potential come by, the number of binding sites didn't change, but the number of cycles changed because there was more calcium in the cell and allowed more cycles to continue on, and we had increased contraction. Remember that? Is that what we said? No, is that what we said? Close enough. Is that what we said?
I knew it before. So I
what? Oh, cycle? An action, myosin cycle. So one movement of a myosin head that way and returned, re-recocked to me as a cycle. So I have more cycles in a period of time, which is more calcium.
Does the extra 20% or the 20% that's coming from the extracellular create a longer? Doesn't that increase the amount of calcium that you're going to have?
So the real question that you're asking is, how are the is the amount of calcium in the cytosol and the number of binding sites for calcium in the cardiac muscle similar to what it is in the skeletal muscle?
And specifically within that, is this 80% the same amount of calcium? And does this extracellular calcium make a difference on
Well, I don't think I don't think that I would say that it's this calcium or that calcium. Once the calcium is in there, it's all calcium.
But if it's the same amount, relative amount of calcium in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and then you're getting this extra amount, like you're getting another source of it that adds to that, you'd have more calcium, which would mean more cycles.
So the assumption in your question is
that they're equal amounts.
That no. The assumption in your question really is that the binding sites in the cardiac sarcomere are the same as the binding sites in the skeletal sarcomere.
That would be a second assumption.
Well, but in my mind, that's the first assumption.
Okay.
That's not the case. So the difference between the calcium that's released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum in the cardiac cell and the calcium released in the sarcoplasmic reticulum in the skeletal cell is that in the cardiac cell, there's not enough calcium to engage all of the binding sites. So the first assumption that you made, that it's the same amount of calcium coming out of sarcoplasmic reticulum, is not right. Because the amount of calcium that comes out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum and that comes on into the cell during one action potential is not enough to reveal all of the binding sites for actin and myosin the way it is in the skeleton. So now, what's the implication of that? If I slow down this pump and I increase the amount of calcium inside this cell, what's going to happen? I'm going to end up with a stronger contraction. We have a name for that. Actually, we have two names for that. One name for that is contractility. So if I use the word contractility, I'm talking only about cardiac muscle, and I'm talking about something related to the amount of calcium that's inside that cytosol. The other term is called inotropic response, the I-N-O-T-R-O-P-I-C, inotropic response. I don't use that, I use contractility. Contractility doesn't mean, I don't see contractility in skeletal muscle. I see contractility in cardiac muscle. What is that? More calcium. So if I have more calcium inside the cytosol, the cardiac muscle, then I have more binding sites available for actin and myosin. In skeletal muscle. This is cardiac muscle. He said that one quantum doesn't bind to all of them. There are more
sites in the cardiac muscle compared to the calcium than there are in skeletons. Very important.
So we're saying that the contractility of the cardiac muscle is due to the extra calcium in the cell, but then there are also more binding sites for the tryptophan and calcium?
Well, the increase or decrease in contractility cardiac muscle is a result of an increase or decrease in cytosolic calcium. Because if I have more calcium, there are more binding sites available for actin myosin.
That because doesn't quite make sense to me. Because there's more calcium, there are more binding sites. Would there be more binding sites, so there's more calcium?
So what's the magic word that I have? No. The magic word is available. Okay? Because there's more calcium and there's more calcium troponin binding sites. There's more calcium, there's going to be more actin myosin binding sites revealed, and I'm going to have stronger contractions. So the difference is the word availability.
It just seems so important.
Everybody see that okay?
Yeah.
One. Number of calcium binding sites in cardiac muscle is greater than number in skeletal muscle. Makes sense. So one way that I might actually increase contractility is by decreasing the rate of this sodium potassium pump. When I have something growing in my backyard, it'll do that. Some nature back thing growing in my backyard. A native wild weed in the state of Washington.
The weed isn't digitalis, but what is?
Foxglove.
Huh?
Foxglove. Digitalis comes from foxglove. I don't know anything about that. I didn't know, because that's not... There are these little labels that come out of the ground, you know, along with the weed comes out of the ground. And you're not going to believe this, I know, but in my neighborhood, shows this little red fox with his hand up. Believe that? What else? Okay.
Foxglove is a blanket?
Yep.
So I'm looking at, there's probably some feeding of a dead horse here, but I'm still not understanding. With this third step that you've written, more calcium leads to more binding, leads to more accent myosin. Is that just sensitivity? It's more sensitive to extra calcium coming in because it's not already all bound every time?
I wouldn't call it sensitivity.
What would you call it?
I would call it availability of binding sites.
But does, so in skeletal muscle, if every time that the calcium is allowed to leave the sarcoplasmic reticulum, it binds every site, adding more calcium doesn't affect the strength of that contraction. Whereas in this,
it doesn't affect the number of heads that are bound.
So if you put it, it's already going to the closed extent.
No, but it can. Oh, no. Okay. No. What you just said was that.
Or is that based on how long the calcium is in the
area? Yeah.
Okay.
If you say, okay, I'm right here and I'll put calcium in here, and this is the skeletal muscle. If you say that calcium is going to bind with all the binding sites on troponin, it means that all the binding sites on the actin is available. Whether or not there's a myosin head there going to catch it is another issue. That has to do with some alignment. So if I have more calcium in that pool, then those are going to stay open longer, are going to allow more cycles to take place, which are going to allow further movement in that.
Okay, so what's...
And the difference in cardiac muscle... The difference from cardiac muscle is that not all of the binding sites for calcium on troponin are bound. So if I put more calcium in, not only do I get more cycles, but I get more connections.
So why would you call that sensitivity to calcium? Because that's what I was trying to...
Because I don't think the word sensitivity knows. I wouldn't think about response. The sensitivity in my mind doesn't fit into that. Maybe it fits in your mind, and that's fine.
Okay. Well, I was just wondering if I could say it in a different way, see if it makes sense in my head. So it's more the in skeletal cells, when you have your influx of calcium, the amount of calcium to the number of binding sites that can be revealed, the amount of calcium is sufficient to reveal all of those, whether they're used or not. And in cardiac, the amount of calcium that comes in is not sufficient to reveal all the binding sites. So in order to reveal all of them, you have to have more calcium come in. So it's just the, I don't want to say ratio, I don't know if that's the right word, but the amount of calcium that you have to unbind everything is just not sufficient enough until you get more calcium in to make those available. To be bound to.
Let's look at this experiment. Pardon? Now let's look at this and tell me what the experiment is first. What are you changing?
Muscle
length. And I will tell you that this experiment is an isometric muscle contraction, a muscle experiment. And the kind of muscle that I have in here is a cardiac papillary muscle. It's just like a piece of intricate muscle. And what's the experiment? What do I do? So she says that I adjust the muscle length, and I apply a stimulus, and I measure the amount of force. And which line, how many times do I run this experiment?
Four.
Do I run it four times?
Oh, no.
No,
it's
continuous.
How many times do I run it?
A lot of times, each time increasing.
How many times do I run that experiment? Okay, how many times do I repeat that length change? So I'm going to start here, I'm going to increase the length, I'm going to stimulate it, and I'm going to get some force, and I'm going to record that, and then I'm going to increase the length again, I'm going to stimulate it. Okay, so let's say that's one experimental run. One experiment. Have we done this before? We done that experiment before with skeletal muscle?
Yeah,
we did. Okay. We did an isometric contraction. And so how many of those experiments have I run in this picture?
Three.
Did I run three or four?
Three.
Well, the last one is
just the elastic.
Okay. So this passive is just the elastic recoil, isn't it? Okay. So I've run three experiments. I ran this one, which was the control, and then I ran this one, and then I ran that one. And you will recall that wasn't a suggestion, that was an order. You will recall that at an optimal length, when we did that skeletal muscle, we got a maximum force generated. So I want to know, what's the difference? So this is total force. The sum of the active force, which is the difference between this line and that line, and the passive force, the difference between that line and the axis. What's the difference between the control and this experiment? Well, what does that mean? Pardon? More calcium where? In the cytosol. So I ran the control, and then I added more calcium in the cytosol, and I did it again. So what does this mean? What does this line represent?
Less calcium.
Not as much calcium. Less calcium. So now we have the real definition of contractility. The definition of contractility is at a given length, at a given muscle length, with a single stimulus, the amount of force developed depends on the amount of calcium in the cytosol. And if I change the amount of calcium in the cytosol, I change the force developed at the same length. If I ran this experiment in a skeletal muscle, I wouldn't get three lines, I'd get one line. So, if I think about the force of contraction of that cardiac muscle, the amount of force that muscle is contracting, what do I have to think about? What factors, from this diagram, what factors are going to affect the amount of force developed from a single stimulation of a cardiac muscle cell?
Concentration of calcium.
Concentration of calcium in the cytosol? And the muscle length. And what's the explanation for this change due to the muscle length? This this increasing force, decreasing force. What's the explanation for that? What decreases?
The amount of force.
Why?
Because not all the active mass
So what we see here is that if I'm thinking of two things, then. One is the alignment of actin and myosin, which is described by the length-tension relationship, force-tension, length-tension relationship. And the other is contractility, is the amount of calcium. Now I will tell you that resting healthy heart is operating on this part of the curve. So if we increase the end-diastolic volume, or the volume in the ventricle prior to contraction, we're going to call that a particular word later on, not now. If I change that, and if I increase that, I'm going to increase the force of contraction. So if more blood comes to the heart, comes to the ventricle, fills the ventricle, what happens to the amount that's pumped?
It increases.
Okay. And if less returns, less is pumped. So the effect is, because of this length-tension relationship, the heart pumps whatever comes to it in a healthy heart. And then we want to talk about what can change contractility later on. Does that all make sense? Yes, no?
Thanks. Yes. Can you help us explain, or you explain a little bit more, just so why it's so, it's not the recoil of the cell that explains the passive force, it's because the actin and heads are not lined up properly? Can we explain that?
No, the passive force is the elastic component.
Oh.
What he was talking about is the difference between this length and that length. And he said that difference represents the alignment of actin and myosin. Okay? So far, so good. What's next? Any questions about this?
So, I do have a question, actually. So, the length of the cardiac muscle cell is changing?
The leg, remember we talked about skeletal muscle. We said the skeletal muscle is attached.
Right.
So it's attached at its optimal length.
Right.
But a cardiac muscle is not attached.
Okay.
And what we're seeing is that normally, in a normal healthy heart, normally this heart is operating on this part of the curve. On the ascending part of the curve. And so we're operating at a length that's below the optimum.
Okay. Because the length of the individual cells is not...
Because the length of the... Because what's pushing that out? What's setting this? In our experiment, we set it by changing the pull on it. But in a heart, in a vessel, it's being changed by the amount of blood that's in there. So as the blood increases, it gets pushed out. The volume increases and the wall increases and the alignment increases.
So I guess I'd be curious. I mean, once I understand why you get the initial bell curve, but then as
why
the length goes... Yeah, why do you get that at the end then? I mean, because that would seem like you're getting it so far past its length that... I'm just not sure I understand that piece of the graph then.
This is update E19. Thank you. this curve here, the total curve, and the passive curve are the curve we're just looking at. And what do we see? Well, at the lower end here, there's overlap of the actin and myosin. It's not at an optimal length. And the series elastic component, or the elastic component, is not really stretched very much. So the passive force of the stretch, recoil force, isn't very much. Recoil force of that stretch. What happens when we get to here? When we get to here, we have good alignment of the actin and myosin. But we still haven't stretched that elastic component to where I'm seeing significant recoil. And then I start to pull it some more, and now I'm beginning to stretch the elastic component. And what's happening at the same time? What's happening at the same time is that I'm decreasing the alignment, because now it's getting too far apart. So what's happening to the active force you can develop? The active force increased, it was at its optimum, and now it's decreasing. So when I get down to here, somewhere around here, what I see is, right here actually, what I see is that there's no force developed actively.
And then it's all just recoil.
It's all just recoil.
Okay.
So that gives me this dip. And now you see this goes back up because it's all recoil. So from here up it's all recoil.
Okay.
And if you take the difference between the curves, you get that curve here. So we're down here. That makes sense. Okay, are we good? Okay. So the next piece then, now we're looking at this pump. We talked about how the muscle works. We talked about how the excitation contraction mechanism works. And the next step is to ask the question, what is it that initiates the depolarization of the heart initiates contraction, so we have to start talking about pacemaker cells. So the first thing, we have to realize that a pacemaker cell is a cardiac muscle cell, but it's a specialized cardiac muscle cell, and it doesn't do the same thing that a ventricular muscle cell does. And so what we want to do is think about what the action potential in that cell is, what the membrane is made up in that cell. Are you all excited to do that? Just really thrilled on how hot to try to do that? Okay. So we'll do that, as Howie Mandel would say. We'll do that right after the break.
There was an article in the New York Times that's kind of related to this. It was an article about stretching. Like another stretching.
And sing along the blue, the wind's open.
So there's never a trick to rest. Sunny morning lies a body just to move the light. And someone's hanging round the corner. Could that someone be Mac the Knife? There's a tugboat down by the river.
I'm trying to find a word that kind of.
Yeah.
I know. How does scurvy happen? I don't even think we've seen it.
She just walked in the room.
Nice matrix conversation.
Algae phosphate, secreted from some compound. So intramembranous is when you have it coming from a mesenchyme, which differentiates into aggregate, becoming vascularized, and then you get an osteoblast. So osteoblasts will produce type 1 collagen to make the new meat, the new bone, which is an osteoid, which is non-mineralized. But the osteoblast also secretes osteoid phosphate, which crystallizes calcium and phosphate for calcification.
That's so clear.
Yeah. So for bones, so for other, for endochondrals, you have hyaline, which gets vascularized and then it turns to bone. So it's really simple. And part of it is that on the hyaline you have perichondria, and that once the hyaline becomes vascularized, it turns into periosteum. And then on this hyaline you have the periosteal collar, which I guess is the part that's pierced by the blood vessel.
Teach me more.
I didn't really want to bust it out in your class. I was like, oh, it's such a nerd.
Did you have it
together? It did. And I was showing them some photographs.
I made a mountain model too. Years ago. Mine's not as good. Or it's detailed.
So anyway. Okay, yeah. It gets translation, and on translation, the tropo collagen, whatever it's going to be made into, needs to be hydroxylated, the amino acids, to hydroxyproline and hydroxylysine. And it's this hydroxylation that requires vitamin C. So if you don't have it, you're just going to have a lot of this stuff being made in the cell, and it'll, yeah.
And what is the collagen that the... Tropocollagen is like a collagen like fiber.
Tropocollagen is just like a polypeptide and it's a scale. And so it just aligns
it makes,
kind of fashion.
So tropocollagen makes
out the helix fibril.
Makes the collagen fibril.
Yes.
Okay, that's a lot of words. Let's do it.
Yeah. So, in the orbis, doesn't he sing that?
Yeah, I think he does.
I know.
No, so the cells of collagen, there's a lot. There's fibroblasts, and endothelium.
cells at the atrioventricular node. Where is that? It's between the atrium and ventricular. Okay. And then we'll also find later on some places, and eventually we'll talk about that later on. But first, we're going to talk about the general principles of a cardiac pacemaker cell. And so on page F12, we again have drawings of the changes in relative permeability that we see in an SA node cell. So this is the permeability of potassium, and this is relative permeability of sodium, and that's the permeability to calcium over a period of time. So your task, again, up on top, is to predict what the membrane potential is going to look like at various times on this time scale. So you start here and you say, well, okay, this is a lot more permeable potassium than sodium or calcium, and so what do I expect the potential to be there? Negative. How negative? A lot negative or not a lot negative? Sure, okay? And so now, what's going to happen if I move to this stuff? Is it going to get more negative or less negative? Okay? And what's going to happen at this time? Okay, so now complete that for this whole time frame. Give you about 15 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
Doing transmembrane potential for potassium.
Okay.
this is the
Okay. So here, calcium. Orange is calcium. Well, my orange, this is calcium.
Yeah. So.
So sodium increases a little bit.
Let's see potassium. I think potassium is what you use.
Yeah, okay, so...
So potassium is going to start out negative on the membrane potential, right?
Yeah.
And then it's going to get a little more positive or less negative.
So the permeability is decreasing. So it's going to be more negative. No. It's going to be less negative.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll kill why.
Permeability of potassium decreases. That means less potassium is going to exit the cell. Which means that it should be.
The membrane potential should rise, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, rise. As
it should get more positive, more or positive? More, less negative, I guess you could say. More positive sound. Easier to do, more logical.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that'll go up.
Like.
To a point, and then the membrane permeability starts to increase, and so the membrane, it'll go down even further, right? It'll start getting negative, and it'll go down even more negative than it was initially. It's like for potassium, it should go like. It should go like there's the initial value.
Okay. Yeah.
Makes sense. Right?
Yes.
And then for...
Sodium.
For sodium.
It's increasing just a little bit, though.
So if sodium permeability is increasing, that would make it more positive, right?
Make it...
Or less negative. Yeah. So...
So both these things are making it less negative.
Yeah. And then the permeability decreases. I think the potassium or the sodium one should look more or less like the curve that's on there. Don't you, or not? Yeah. It should look, the sodium one should look more or less like the sodium one there, shouldn't it?
Yeah.
And the calcium one should be, potassium should be more or less inverted.
So calcium should be.
Yeah.
Sodium and calcium should be roughly the same.
Potassium should be inverse. And the calcium, he said that there's not as many calcium channels, so maybe it doesn't have as hard. Maybe it's just a little bit of an effect.
Are we supposed to separate it out here? Like, how potassium?
I was just drawing them on the side.
We're just looking for one graph, all three of us.
Yeah. Did you go swimming today?
No, not a chance.
Yeah.
Not great stuff. Something's definitely going on here. All of them kind of converge.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that is the peak or the plateau or.
That's got to be the plateau.
Yeah.
Well, overall, I guess for the cell in this time frame, it's becoming like more positive. So it'd be going all like this. This is my guess.
Wait. So.
What?
was just thinking. Yeah, it makes sense.
Because they're all three of the ions are making a cell more positive.
No, potassium's making it. It's like the efflux of potassium. Potassium's leaving the cell, so that would make the inside of the cell more negative, right?
Yeah, but it's decreasing.
Yeah, so it's decreasing there.
Uh-huh.
So all three of these initially, yeah, you're right.
They're making cells
causing
positive.
It to rise more positive.
So in the middle,
I think you're right in the middle, like where that calcium's there, that's maintaining that plateau.
So potassium is decreasing even more. Sodium increasing.
Is it gonna be just like that other graph, this one? Sort of?
I think, yeah, like the composite of them all should be.
Yeah.
But are we supposed to do one for each one of the elements? Or? We'll let Inika draw it. Inika.
It says predict the membrane voltage. How the membrane voltage will change as a function of time.
Okay.
So I think you have to take into account all of that.
What's it start at?
Minus 70.
Minus 90.
Minus 90.
Minus 90. Get it straight. Silly Canadians. You're not necessarily Canadian.
Yeah. I am Canadian. I have dual citizenship.
Silly American. Yeah.
Okay. So the middle.
3, 4, 5. Okay.
Calcium.
Okay.
And keep on going up. But sodium decreases. Well, it goes up. And then probably, I don't know.
It plateaus.
Yeah. Because sodium decreases. But we don't know, like, the relative. Like, how much. Like the relative, yeah, the permeability to each one compared to the other one. It's kind of hard to say.
Well, you know the permeability is compared to the other ones right there, but you don't know, like, the relative number of channels.
Yeah. Like
but
how...
you said that there's not as many calcium channels, that's what I was saying. Calcium.
Yeah. Anyway.
What do you think, like, this bump right there where they're all not equal is?
I don't know, but I want to know what the, like, camel's hump sodium is. That's kind of weird. It's like they close and then open again? So maybe it would do the same thing. But higher. That's my guess. Mm-hmm. When calcium increases again, so the cell will go back down. And calcium. I don't know.
Why do you think it'll do that?
Just because that's what sodium's doing.
Yeah.
Maybe. Potassium's also starting to increase there too, so it should be getting more negative when that happens. That's what I think.
Okay. Tell me what you got.
A mountain.
think it would go back up in the end, too. I think it would go down.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of comes back up to that 90.
Start out here. What do you got? Tell me where to put it.
Negative 70.
Okay. So we'll put this right here. Okay.
Negative 90. It rises very slowly for a little bit as the permeability of potassium lowers and the other ones come up.
She says it's going to rise very slowly. And then what's going to happen?
Rise more steeply.
When is it going to rise more steeply?
When all those points start intersecting.
All those points are intersecting right here. And then what's going to happen? Calcium channels open. And where do those live? Do they live in the sarcoplasmic reticulum? In the what? And the sarcolemma, in the cell membrane. Why? Why did we say that? Because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the inside of the cell minus the outside of the cell. The cytosol minus the extracellular fluid. We're not talking about sarcoplasmic reticulum here. We talk about that when we talk about contraction. So, gee, it looks like there are some voltage-gated calcium channels here. You think there are a lot of voltage-gated sodium channels in this cell membrane?
No.
So this is different. And there are some funny potassium channels that look like they're closing. Does this have a resting potential? Well, let's see what our picture in the book looks like. Picture in the book looks like that. Is there a resting potential shown there? Yes or no?
No.
Why not? Why would you not say that there's a resting potential? What would that have to do to be a resting potential? Megan goes, it's got to do this. It's got to be resting. So what's going to happen in this cell? This is kind of neat. What's going to happen? If I measure the membrane potential across this cell over time, what am I going to see?
At the
I'm going to see another one over here, another one over here, another one over here, another one over here.
Where's the next one going
to be? Or here. I'll call this a pacemaker position. And I would define a pacemaker potential as a membrane potential that spontaneously depolarizes at a certain point, and then there's a voltage-gated channel. So, in your picture you have, and on here in this description, you have some sodium in here, but if you really look at the shape of this curve, what are the major ions that you're thinking about? Calcium? Potassium. Well, there are some sodium channels involved there, and some sodium leakage involved. And what happens along here are two things. There's a little increase in sodium permeability, and there's a decrease in potassium permeability. So they're spontaneously closing channels. Ask me what causes them to close. I have no idea. Do you have any idea? There is a sodium current in here, though, that's called, get ready to laugh, funny current. And I've never figured out what's so funny about that current, but it doesn't do things the way you expect it to do. So there's some kind of funny current. So there are a whole bunch of channels in here, and the population of channels are such that permeability of potassium decreases until the cell depolarizes enough to trigger voltage-gated calcium channels. Voltage-gated calcium channels open, and then we start seeing a change in the potassium permeability. So this shows you the movement of ions and the membrane potential, and that's a pacemaker. Where might I find pacemakers? Oh, in the heart. May I find pacemakers someplace else?
In a marathon, I might find a pacemaker.
Yes.
Is it yes?
In the 1500, I'll find a pacemaker. Find pacemakers in the stomach. Find pacemakers in the gut. Find pacemakers all over the place. We'll talk more about this later. But the characteristic is they spontaneously depolarize. No outside influence, and then show an action. So I find these in the SNO. Any questions about what's happening there? So now here we have a picture of a
heart.
It has an SA node. It has an AV node. It has a junction here, the AV node. And down here are some more conduction systems. Now, judging from that picture, what do we have? We see here that here are the action potentials along there. And where would I find... Where would I find pacemaker potentials, do you think? What cells are pacemaker cells on this picture?
First
top one.
And then the third one.
The third one. Is that it? But if you look real carefully, you find that this one has a slight slope as well. This one here. And so we have the SA node, we have the AV node, we have the bundle of HIS. A guy by the name of HIS, so that's my bundle. And down here we have Purkinje fibers. And the Purkinje fibers then carry that, set that, and distribute that action potential throughout the ventricular muscle.
told me that you learned in biology and you learned in high school science that blood went from the right atrium, came from the vena cava into the right atrium, went into the right ventricle, went into the pulmonary artery, went from the pulmonary artery to the pulmonary vein, went from the pulmonary vein to the left atrium, went from the left atrium to the left ventricle, went out into the aorta, right? So when does the right ventricle contract compared to the left ventricle?
Before it.
I heard a before it and I heard the same time. Why do you say before it?
I say before it because, well, what kind of scale are we talking? Are we talking like milliseconds?
Any scale you want.
Without thinking about it too hard, I think it contracts before it because, I don't know, I guess it would have to be the same time. I can logic both ways.
Why would it have to, okay, so now, why, Laura, why did you say at the same time?
I said the same time because the Purkinje fiber should be distributing to the bottom of the ventricles and then the contraction should spread out from there throughout the whole part.
If I look at the picture and I see the signals going down here, and this is going to the left side and that's going to the right side, they're both, the left ventricle and right ventricle are being depolarized at the same time. And so, they both depolarize, contract at the same time. If I think about that movie picture of flow through it, then according to that scheme, the right has to happen first. But it doesn't. They both happen at the same time, which tells you that, blood doesn't go the way they told you it goes. It goes continuously, and that's the path.
But the heart doesn't really stop at any time. Things are moving all the time. Except for the vegetables are probably more vegetables.
Okay?
Do those cells, when it's transmitting it down to the vegetables, use gap junctions to communicate?
All gap junctions.
And if so, then isn't the cell, how does it keep self-propagating? Because wouldn't it lose a little bit of sodium or something?
Let's go back to this picture. And we said now that this cell gets depolarized. And sodium and calcium enter the cell. And we said that positive ions are going to move from this cell to that cell. What are they going to cause to happen?
Depolarization
and action potential. So now sodium and calcium channels here are going to open. And there's going to be positive ions that move in. And they're going to continue on here. So we're not looking at these same ions going from here to here to here. We're talking about ions moving from here to here, reaching threshold for voltage-gated channels in cell B. And now we're having a replenishment, if you will, of the ions that are going to move this way. And so in that way, sure, wherever the gradients may take.
So is it, there's not a loop that's just like a linear progression of cells being, it doesn't like come back.
Normally, it doesn't come back. And so if we look at this, what we see here is that there is a difference in the size, if you want to think about it as the size of the gap junction. From the resistance or the conductance of the gap junctions along a path between here and here that's faster than it is in this atrial muscle. There's a preferential pathway between here and the left atrium that's a little faster than to the right atrium. So So there's a differential in the, in, or preferred pathways, or not preferred isn't the word, but a distribution of pathways where the conduction velocities are different that actually cause the signal that we're concerned about to move from the SA node to the NE node and then to the next. Now look what happens. If we look at the time scale, we see that there's very little time between the SA node and the atrial muscle and the AV node. Boom, 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 very quick. What happens between the AV node and the Purkinje system? There's a delay. There's a delay. And that delay is a result of an increased resistance here in the bundle of discs. There are situations where that pathway could be blocked, or that pathway could have increased resistance. In which case, what's going to generate the pace for the ventricle? That one on the bottom. These Purkinje cells then, have a pacemaker potential. They will then start activating, or start depolarizing, or start stimulating the rest of the ventricular muscle. So you won't have necessarily the coordination between the atrium and the ventricle. I'll talk about that later. So the real question then is, if I think about these three pacemaker cells, three populations of pacemaker cells, why is that one running the show? Why is the SA node running the show?
Because it's
set
at faster pace than the
other one. So what happens if it sets the faster pace?
It like took over. Like they wanted to go, but it already went for them.
Everybody understand that? That makes sense? So who are the percussionists in here? I heard some percussionists. Come on, it's percussion major. Okay, I need two more percussionists.
Charles.
Okay, how about clap?
Sure, I'll be it.
Piano is percussion. Just indirect.
Hey, Alex.
So here we have Alex is the AV node, and Charles is the SA node. Okay? Megan is the Purkinje system. Now each of these three cells have their own spontaneous rate, their own spontaneous rate of depolarization. So here's your rate. This is your rate. You're in the AV node. Okay, and your rate was? His rate is? And your rate is? Got it? Okay. So now, here's what happens. Alex hears Charles clap. He claps. Megan hears Alex clap. She claps. If Alex doesn't hear Charles clap, he reverts to his spontaneous rate because he's not getting any stimulation prior to the time he would. And if Megan doesn't hear Alex, then she reverts back to her spontaneous. Everybody got it? Okay. So you hear him, you clap. You hear him, you clap.
And if I don't, I still clap.
You still clap
to my own drummer.
To your own drummer. Okay, ready? Okay, let's start.
Does it make a difference to the efficiency of the heart, do you think? We'll talk about this more
Excellent. Does it make a difference in the efficiency of the heart if I really have atrial fibrillation or not?
Somewhat.
Somewhat. So keep that thought. Maybe.
Or yes,
or
but not.
Maybe not. But the answer is the standard modal answer, of course. It depends. And what it depends on, is what the activity, what the demands on the heart are. We'll come back to that again later. Agree?
You were talking about the cells in the atrium not reaching a refractory
period,
which would cause all the
chaos. No, I say if in fact they're stimulated, if the pattern is such that it doesn't hit the cell next to it, when that cell is in refractory period, it's going to be stimulated. And so instead of an organized depolarization, you're going to have chaotic depolarization. So how can I? We should really talk about this. We talk about ventricular fibrillation. But how can I? One way that I might be able to reestablish that normal rhythm. It's hard to do what I'm talking about. Only in the atrium, but theoretically, what could I do? And what would I do if I defibrillated?
You're just going to stop the heart for a second and then it'll start up on its own rhythm.
And why?
Because you stir all the cells and then they hit a refractory period where the main signal can start again.
So what I've done, if I depolarize the whole mass at once, and we'll look at this later on, but depolarize the whole mass at once, and everything is in a refractory period at the same time. But these cells are spontaneously depolarized. And so when they then have an action potential, if everything is okay, you started that whole series again. We'll look at that. We'll look at it more with respect to ventricular fibrillation. We'll get some pictures.
You can go first. I think you have some questions.
I just don't understand why in atricular fibrillation, they're not hitting a refractory period.
Okay. We talk about atrial fibrillation.
Oh, I wrote
that. Okay. Now, we didn't talk about ventricular fibrillation. It's the same principle. If they hit a cell that's in a refractory period, the cell won't get stimulated. If those voltage-gated sodium channels with time and activation gates are closed, then that cell is not going to get stimulated. But if the neighboring cell is not in a refractory period, it will get stimulated. So what you're really doing is saying, normally everything's coordinated. But if you go, she goes, she goes, she goes, she stimulates again, and you're not in a refractory period, you're going to start a circle around you and a local current. You can have all these local currents going around and all these local depolarizations and not get anything effective in terms of any mechanical pumping.
So each individual cell is in a refractory period at some point, but it's
that's
just
right.
That they're not in it at the time when the...
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. So with a ventricular cell, they're in a refractory period in here, or here, when the voltage-gated channels are open and not closed yet, or when the time where the time and activation gates have not yet reset on the sodium channels. In the atrial muscle, there's some time in here. And what you see here is this is related, this looks like it's related to a voltage-gated sodium channel with time and activation gates as well. The membrane then is slightly different in the pacemaker cells than this is in the atrial muscles.
So could that atrial fibrillation keep going? Because some point the time and activation gates kick in and stop that cycle because they're time and activated.
If a big enough area gets into refractory, then it'll stop. What they call circus movements going on, if you have different cells depolarizing the neighbors at different times, what can cause that to happen? One thing causing it to happen that you think more of the ventricular muscle and not the atrial muscle is what happens if oh, let's say in Modell's heart. Let's get personal. Where this whole wall is dead. There's not much of scar tissue. If there's scar tissue, it doesn't conduct. So now you have to find other pathways. And if something, if that scar tissue causes too big of a delay at any particular time, then that can start some fibrillation as well. All right.
So far, so good.
Does this all make sense? Yeah? Okay. So let's look at the next page. Let's look at this experiment. And so here we have our pacemaker cell. We're recording as a function of time. Now run three experiments. What are the experiments?
The control.
Sympathetic stimulation.
And so what did I do? I could have added a neurotransmitter, and if I did that, what neurotransmitter would I have added?
Acetylcholine.
Sympathetic stimulation?
Well,
epinephrine. Norepinephrine. Okay. And then what did I see? Oh, wait a minute. Maybe we shouldn't do that experiment. What happens in the third experiment? What did I do?
You added acetylcholine.
I added acetylcholine, or I could have stimulated the vagus nerve. I could have stimulated a sympathetic nerve that was going, if I was looking at this in a heart. But let's take those cells and put them in a petri dish and look at the stimulation. And so here we have the control, and now I've added epinephrine or norepinephrine. Tell me what happened. More calcium channels.
Well, I guess it could be either on the sarcolemma. I don't know. I mean, yeah. Or the sarcoplasmic reticulum.
No, we're not talking about sarcoplasmic reticulum here. Because we're measuring the membrane potential of the cell. Okay? So I can open calcium channels. So maybe there's some ligand-gated calcium channels there that are opened by the catecholamine. How else might I do it? I could what? Lower the permeability of potassium faster. So I can do one of those two things. Now I will tell you, this is a pacemaker cell, but if I stimulate the sympathetics, there are sympathetic nerves that go to the SA node, and there are also sympathetic nerves that go to the ventricle. And if I increase the sympathetic stimulation of the ventricle, I get an increase in contractility. So what happens in those ventricular cells to cause an increase in contractility? I have more calcium coming into the cell. So if I want to make some sort of a unifying model for myself and keep things straight, would you suggest that this is most likely opening of calcium channels? Or closing the potassium channels? Opening calcium channels. Is that truly what happens? I don't know. I don't care.
Because with this model allows me to make the predictions I need to make, and they sense what's happening in the ventricle with the same neurotransmitter. Because with the same neurotransmitter doing the same thing, I expect to find maybe the same kind of receptors there. All right. Well, that's good. So, what's the effect? What's the effect of stimulation of yes and no by the sympathetic? Then the heart rate
increases.
It increases. Let's do the other experiment. Now let's expose this to acetylcholine. What do you see the difference there?
A decrease in the heart rate.
A decrease in the heart rate. Okay? And why do you think you have it? What, how would you explain it on the basis of that diagram?
Decrease the amount of calcium in the cell.
Well, maybe, but you notice that the height of the action potential is pretty much the same. And if I decrease the amount of calcium channels open, I'd expect not as much calcium to come in, not as much depolarization. Increase the amount of potassium channels.
Something with potassium,
Charles.
Savan noted that the hyperpolarization goes lower. So that would make sense that if the calcium requires the potassium channels
were
open more.
Savan noticed that this level is below that level, suggesting that the number of potassium channels opening during the repolarization has increased. Is there anything changed in the cell in the channel population that's causing this the pacemaker potential from the picture? Question is, from the picture, do I think that there's a difference in the population of potassium channels that are closing or sodium channels that are opening? Potassium channels that are closing that cause the depolarization of the pacemaker cell.
No, they seem to be in the same grade.
They seem to be...
Oh, just the slope.
Just
comparing
the slope.
The slope
seems to be the same. And so the reason that the heart rate is slowed is because that decay has to occur from a lower value. And so it takes longer to do it. So in my mind, I think about acetylcholine causing an increase in the number of potassium channels open during repolarization. And I think of epinephrine as causing an increase in the number of calcium channels during the pacemaker protection. Hi, Teresa.
I'm sorry, so you said that with the catecholamine, that's an increase of calcium channels, and with the acetylcholine that
so
you're...
I see this response as being related to calcium,
correct.
And I see this response as being related to calcium.
And so you're increasing...
Increasing the number of potassium channels open during repolarization.
During repolarization.
Okay. I need to put the tables and chairs back. Don't forget your name tags. We'll collect cars, and we'll pick up this discussion tomorrow and start talking.